Welcome to The Debate. What if the crushing fatigue, the, you know, systemic inflammation and the brain fog of chronic illness aren't actually signs that your body is fundamentally broken?
Right. Like it's not just a glitch in the system.
Exactly. What if, instead, they're proof that it is executing a brilliant, desperate strategy to keep you alive?
It's an incredibly provocative question, because we are so conditioned to view illness precisely like a mechanical breakdown. A car engine starts smoking, the mechanic points to a cracked piston and says, "There's your problem."
Yeah, totally.
We expect that exact same precision from human biology, you know?
Right. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and it's binary. It's broken or it's not broken. It's clean, it's visible, and, I mean, it is comforting to have something to point at.
But then you step into the world of a chronic illness, or neurodevelopment, or stress physiology, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just completely useless. We find ourselves looking at a diagnostic landscape that is the absolute definition of muddy waters. You have patients with severe, debilitating symptoms, yet their standard lab panels come back perfectly normal.
Which brings us directly to the core of what we are dissecting today. We are looking at a framework proposed by Dr. Bishara Saheli in his paper, Mitochondria, Structural Coupling, and Intrinsic Health. What Saheli has done here is, well, it's incredibly ambitious.
It really is.
He has taken Humberto Maturana's Biology of Living, which is his deeply philosophical, systems-level view of how life organizes itself, and synthesized it with Martin Picard's cutting-edge work on mitochondrial psychobiology.
And out of that synthesis emerges a central question that completely upends how we view the human organism. Under this non-reductionist framework, should we primarily understand chronic disease as a successful, albeit incredibly expensive, organizational adaptation to a hostile environment? Or does it fundamentally represent an internal, material failure of energetic capacity at the cellular level?
Today, I will be representing the position that chronic illness is fundamentally what the text calls costly conserved drift. Basically, an active, adaptive, relational conservation of life under severe constraint. The organism isn't broken. It is successfully surviving an inhospitable medium.
And I will be taking the contrasting view. I will argue that while the relational perspective is conceptually elegant, chronic illness fundamentally represents a loss of intrinsic health. It is an objective, material failure driven by the loss of redox congruence and excessive energy resistance right at the mitochondrial level.
Okay, so let's start by laying the foundation for this relational view. When we look at Maturana's concept of structural determinism, it just completely shatters our standard input-output model of disease.
Mm-hmm.
In the traditional view, an external stressor, say a toxin or an emotional trauma, enters the body and directly causes a specific predictable damage. But Maturana points out that a living system just doesn't work that way.
Let's pause right there. Before we go further, we really need to unpack Maturana's concept of autopoiesis, because that is the bedrock of his argument here. For those tracking with us, we aren't just talking about homeostasis, right? We're not just talking about a thermostat maintaining a room's temperature.
Exactly. Autopoiesis literally means self-creation. It describes a living system whose entire physical structure is constantly, endlessly, dedicated to rebuilding and maintaining its own boundaries and its own organization.
Right.
And because the system is autopoietic, the environment cannot instruct the organism on what to do. The environment only perturbs it. How the organism responds to that perturbation is entirely determined by its own internal structure at that exact moment in time, its unique history, and its drive to keep existing.
Right. The structure determines the response.
Precisely. Therefore, when we look at chronic states like systemic inflammation or metabolic rigidity, we really shouldn't view these as mechanical defects. They are active, highly organized responses. The organism is engaging in costly, conserved drift.
But at a massive cost.
Yes, it is successfully maintaining its living coherence. It hasn't died, but it is doing so under constrained conditions that exact a massive energetic, emotional, and behavioral toll. The system is executing a desperate, coordinated strategy to survive a medium that is fundamentally lacking the conditions it needs.
I come at it from a slightly different way. I agree that Maturana's relational theory is a beautiful way to understand life globally. But Picard's inclusion of bioenergetics grounds this entire discussion in stark, unforgiving thermodynamic limits.
Okay.
We cannot abstract away the physical reality of the mitochondrion. Picard's work moves us far past the old middle school biology trope of the powerhouse of the cell, but it also firmly establishes that living requires actual energy transformation. And that transformation encounters what he calls energy resistance.
I want to make sure we are entirely clear on what that means for the listener. What exactly does energy resistance look like inside the cell?
Think of it as molecular friction. When a cell takes in substrates, you know, food, oxygen, it has to transform them into a usable energetic currency, primarily ATP. But this process isn't perfectly efficient.
Sure.
When a system faces reductive stress, it means there is an excess of reducing pressure. In chemical terms, we are talking about too much NADH, or reduced glutathione, that the cell simply cannot transform into organized work.
Okay, I have to stop you there and put myself in the listener's shoes. When you say reductive stress and too much NADH, how does that actually cause a systemic breakdown? Walk us through that mechanism.
Let's use an analogy. Think of the electron transport chain inside your mitochondria like a highly coordinated bucket brigade trying to put out a fire. The electrons are the buckets of water. They are being handed down a line of proteins.
Got it.
At the very end of the line, oxygen is waiting to catch the electrons and safely turn into water. But what happens if you have way too many buckets being shoved into the line? That's the excess NADH, and not enough oxygen at the end to catch them.
The whole line jams up.
Exactly. The line jams up, the buckets spill. That is literal electron congestion. And when electrons spill out of the transport chain, they interact with oxygen prematurely and create highly reactive oxygen species, or ROS.
So, free radicals.
Yes. This isn't merely an expensive adaptation or a philosophical shift in relations. It is a molecular failure mode. The organism's intrinsic health, its internal physical capacity to maintain coordinated energy and structure, objectively breaks down when this energy resistance becomes too high. There is a thermodynamic point where the biology simply breaks.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on the nature of that physical reality. Because I don't disagree with the biochemistry of the bucket brigade. What I disagree with is calling it a failure.
Okay.
We need to distinguish between a stressor acting as direct damage versus a stressor acting as a perturbation that triggers a defensive posture. The electron congestion you're talking about depends entirely on the organism's history of structural coupling with its medium.
But the damage is objectively real. The buckets are spilling.
Is it damage or is it reallocation? Let me offer an alternative analogy here. Think of a wartime economy. When a city is under siege, the government might intentionally ration electricity.
Sure.
They shut off the streetlights and the power to the residential suburbs so they can keep the radar systems online and the hospital ventilators running. Now, if you're an outside observer looking at the pitch dark streets, you might say, wow, look at this. The grid is defective. The infrastructure has failed.
Right, because the lights are out.
Exactly. But it hasn't failed at all. It is executing a brilliant, necessary prioritization to conserve the unity of the whole city. In the human body, shifting into a highly inflammatory, metabolically rigid state, even allowing some ROS leakage, is the rationing of electricity. It's defensive conservation.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. I understand the wartime rationing analogy, but it completely falls apart at the microscopic level. Shutting off the streetlights is a functional, administrative adaptation, yes.
Okay.
But what happens if the power plant's core actually melts down because the physical resistance in the transmission lines generates too much heat? That is what happens in the cell.
Wait, you're saying the cell's power plant is literally melting?
Yes, essentially. The text specifically details the mechanisms of oxidative and reductive stress as a loss of redox congruence. When those spilled buckets, the reactive oxygen species, exceed the system's innate buffering and repair capacity, it causes actual, irreversible macromolecular damage.
To the local structures.
To the lipids, the proteins, and critically, the mitochondrial DNA itself. You are treating energy resistance like a mere administrative decision by the organism to route energy elsewhere. But Picard's energy resistance principle shows that excessive resistance produces heat, oxidative stress, and information loss.
Well,
if the core melts down, the structural coupling of the organism to its environment fails entirely. It is no longer an adaptation. It is a breakdown of the structural integrity required to live.
That is a compelling argument, but I would argue that your focus on the microscopic meltdown sort of misses the forest for the trees.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The macromolecular damage you are referring to, the ROS exceeding the buffering capacity, doesn't occur in a vacuum. It occurs precisely because the organism is forced to operate in an environment that demands that massive level of energetic output without offering the niche conditions for recovery.
Okay, but...
And this forces us to look at how this bioenergetic reality scales up to the behavioral and psychological level.
You mean what Maturana calls emotioning?
Exactly. The text defines emotioning not as abstract feelings, but as bodily dispositions that specify our domains of action. If we view disease solely as an isolated molecular error, like an overflowing bucket brigade, we miss the coherence of the whole human being.
How do you mean? Give me an example.
Take chronic fatigue. In your view, fatigue is an ATP deficit, a failure of the power plant. But through the lens of costly conserved drift, fatigue is profoundly reframed as a narrowed organismic possibility under energetic load.
Meaning the body is choosing to slow down.
It is actively restricting the domain of action to prevent the very meltdown you're talking about. It makes you tired, so you stop spending energy you don't have. Or take anxiety.
Right.
Anxiety isn't just a broken brain chemistry. It is a persistent readiness for threat driven by altered neuroendocrine and immune coupling. The body is anticipating a hostile environment. These are highly coordinated, nested expressions of living coherence. They are protective.
I see what you're saying.
If you are a patient experiencing this, understanding that your body is intelligently restricting your energy to save your life, well, that is a revolutionary shift in perspective.
Protective initially, perhaps, but we must confront the danger of the positive feedback loop inherent in what Sali defines as costly conserved drift. Let's look really closely at that term.
Costly conserved drift.
Right. A costly pattern is conserved because it allows short-term survival. But what happens when those narrowed action domains persist? When fatigue, social withdrawal, and anhedonia become the default state, they actively entrench the maladaptation.
They become their own environment.
Precisely. The text points out that this trajectory calcifies into a rigid state where energy flow is no longer congruent. The organism loses its adaptive flexibility. It's surviving, yes, but it is robbed of the adaptive freedom required to actually live. Let's talk about the mechanisms of that calcification, like fusion-fission dynamics and mitophagy.
Break those down for us, because those are heavy terms.
Sure. Mitochondria are not static beings floating in a cell. They constantly fuse together to share resources, and they undergo fission, meaning they split apart, to isolate damaged components.
Like a network reconfiguring itself.
Exactly. And when a mitochondrion is too damaged by that ROS leakage we discussed, the cell uses a process called mitophagy to essentially take out the trash, digesting the broken mitochondrion. But under chronic reductive stress, these dynamics fail.
They just stop?
The mitochondria become fragmented. Mitophagy halts entirely. You just accumulate cellular trash.
So the defense mechanism gets jammed.
Completely jammed. So when you describe fatigue as a protective restriction, I have to push back. When mitophagy fails, that fatigue is no longer just a protective emotioning or a clever behavioral choice by the organism.
You're saying it's purely structural at that point.
Yes, it is an objective lack of energetic currency. The domain of action isn't just narrowed by disposition. It is physically barricaded by an overwhelming burden of biological wear and tear.
Okay, I hear that. But that calcification you're describing, that loss of adaptive freedom, is still fundamentally a relational phenomenon. It is the result of the organism being structurally coupled to an environment that continually demands that defensive posturing. And this is exactly why this distinction matters so much when we talk about the path to healing.
Okay, walk me through that.
If disease is an altered relation to the medium, if it is a prolonged wartime economy, then healing cannot merely be a mechanical repair of the power plant. Healing must be what the text calls relational recoupling.
Right, right.
To cure a wartime economy, you have to end the war. Sahali makes a massive paradigm shift here. He asserts that meaning, relational safety, movement, and sleep are not just soft lifestyle factors. They are literally the niche conditions for conserved living.
You have to change the ecological and social medium so that the organism receives the signal of safety. Only then will it stop mobilizing that massive defensive energetic burden.
I agree that we cannot ignore the environment, but you are entirely skipping over the physical bottleneck.
Well, I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because if I'm listening to this right now, I might be thinking, okay, but how does feeling socially unsafe actually change my mitochondrial function?
It's a fair question, right? Because if the organism's structure dictates its response, throwing mitochondrion supplements at a person who is structurally coupled to a hostile psychosocial environment is biologically meaningless, isn't it? If they are still at war, optimizing their mitochondria just gives them more energy to sustain the destructive inflammatory defense.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the concept of organelle niche coupling? This is explicitly outlined in the text. The mitochondrion is not a passive recipient of systemic safety signals coming from the brain. It recursively shapes its own intracellular niche.
Meaning it creates its own local environment?
Exactly. The mitochondrial niche includes the local oxygen tension, the substrate supply, the NAD plus to NADH ratio we talked about earlier. If a system is locked in redox incongruence, if the bucket brigade is permanently jammed and cellular trash is piling up, simply putting that person in a safe, loving social environment will not automatically fix the intracellular bottleneck.
Because the structure of the cell itself is too altered.
Right. The damage has altered the structural determinism of the cell. The mitochondria themselves are sending distress signals. They release reactive oxygen species, and they even extrude cell-free mitochondrial DNA out into the cytoplasm in the bloodstream.
Oh, wow.
And here is the kicker. To the rest of the body, mitochondria DNA looks exactly like bacterial DNA, because mitochondria originally evolved from bacteria.
Wait, really? The body mistakes its own mitochondria for an infection?
Yes. So the immune system sees this DNA and triggers a massive inflammatory response. The cell is locked into a state of panic, regardless of what is happening in the outside room.
It's sounding the alarm from inside the house.
Exactly. Healing requires restoring the physical bioenergetic capacity, so the organism actually has the energetic currency to participate in that new, safer medium. You can declare peace all you want, but if the citizens are too starved to rebuild the city, the peace treaty doesn't change their physical reality.
I actually love that extension of the analogy, because I think it brings us to a really sophisticated synthesis. You're pointing out that the structure of the organism has been so altered by the costly drift that it can no longer couple congruently with a safe medium, even if one is provided.
Right. The internal structure is out of sync with the external reality.
Yes. The mitochondria, as energetic relational participants, have structured themselves for threat. It's what Saley means when he says healing is the restoration of viable coupling across scales, from the ecological medium to the social relation, down to the tissue, the cell, and the organelle.
Mm-hmm.
If we only focus on the molecular substrates without addressing the relational safety, we are just delivering premium fertilizer to a plant that is still sitting in a freezing pitch black room.
And inversely, if we only provide the warm sunlit room without providing the basic physical nutrients and unjamming the biochemical pathways, the plant still cannot grow. We have to recognize the unyielding energetic constraints that govern whether living coherence can be sustained.
Exactly.
You simply cannot outthink or outfeel a severe lack of electron transport capacity. Intrinsic health has a thermodynamic cost. We have to balance the redox state and lower that excessive energy resistance so that the mitochondria can actually power the systemic behavioral shifts you're talking about.
This is why viewing disease through the compassionate lens of costly conserved drift is so vital for the future of medicine. It forces us to recognize the body's desperate, highly organized attempt to maintain coherence.
Absolutely.
It removes the profound stigma of the body somehow failing or betraying the patient. And instead, it honors the incredible lengths to which the biology has gone to keep the person alive under adverse conditions.
I think that is where we find our deepest point of convergence today. The purely mechanistic, reductionist view of mitochondria as mere powerhouses that just blindly pump out ATP until they break is dead.
It is totally dead.
And similarly, the view of chronic disease as an isolated machine defect is obsolete. What Saheli has done by bringing Picard and Maturana together is show us that health is not merely the absence of a broken part. Health is a dynamic, positive biological condition. It is living coherence, conserved energetically.
It is a remarkable conceptual leap. It asks us, both as clinicians and as human beings, to hold two incredibly complex realities at once. We have to hold the microscopic precision of redox chemistry in one hand and the lived, emotional, relational history of a human being in the other, without collapsing one into the other.
It certainly makes you think about your daily life differently. When you realize that every sleepless night, every chronically stressful encounter, but also every moment of deep relational safety and meaningful work, it's all literally being translated into electron flow and mitochondrial architecture.
It's wild to think about.
The synthesis of molecular depth and organismic relation here provides profound new distinctions. There is a whole world of research and clinical application that needs to be explored here.
There really is. And it brings us right back to that broken X-ray machine we started with. When we look at a patient dealing with chronic illness, we are no longer just looking for a jagged white line, a broken part to simply patch or replace.
No, not at all.
We are looking at a living, breathing, autopoietic system, dynamically adjusting its own structural boundaries to conserve its coherence in a complex world. We will leave you to reflect on your own structural coupling and what specific niche conditions you might need to cultivate to conserve your own living coherence. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.